All right, welcome back, and thank you so much for sticking with us. And we're going to get to my favorite part of the show, the interview part, where I'm sure you guys feel the same way. You had enough listening to me blow hot air into the mic. But got a special guest on we wanted to have on for quite some time. And he's had some really interesting calls this year. He's had some great calls this year. And want to just get his take on what's going on. Obviously, this is a very interesting market environment. So without further ado, want to introduce you to Mr. Harris Cuppy out of Florida. He's been kind enough to join us on the podcast today. Harris, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure. So we get in here, and I've followed you for a while on Twitter. And for those of you who don't know, you can follow him at H Cuppy, K-U-P-P-Y. On Twitter, and one of the guys, I don't follow a lot of people. I think my total followers is about 250, 260. Tend to focus on the guys that are actually making calls, putting themselves out there, bringing forth research. You do that. And before we even get it, look, you have become, whether you like it or not, Mr. Tanker. So we'll cover that. And I know you don't like it. It's just a position of the portfolio, but it sure seems to have captured a lot of attention. But there was a part this year, right around March, where I thought you were patently out of your mind. You got all bulled up when it looked like, well, look, we by far the most violent, quickest onsetting economic crisis in U.S. history. Markets acted accordingly. And you were one of the first guys there at the bottom. It was you and Jimmy Jude, the Florida contingent I'm referring to you guys as. you got all bulled up. You got all bulled up on stocks when everybody was saying the sky was falling. And I'm one of them. I didn't cash out. We held our high conviction positions, and I thank God we did. But just walk me through that. Walk me through why you were one of the first bullish voices that really got fired up and was extraordinarily animated about it and didn't shy away from it. What did you see? And just kind of walk me through your process during that period of time and where that, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back where you said, okay, it's go time now. You got to ignore the fear and go in there and buy with both hands.
Well, I mean, just for some backstory, I've been doing this for over 20 years. I've seen up markets, I've seen down markets, and I've seen a lot of in between. And you know, I know that you want to buy them when they're down. You don't want to be buying them when they're going up. Who wants to overpay? So I always sit there with a bunch of extra cash and a bunch of liquidity, and I wait for things to happen where I can have a differing view. You know, a lot of people say they're a contrarian, and I'm an actual contrarian, not just one of those contrarians who, you know, does the same thing that everyone else does. Yeah, you know the joke. I'm a contrarian just like all my friends.
Right. Yeah, 100%.
So, you know, when the market was falling apart, I was looking at it and saying, you know, a lot of these stocks, if you look at the overall market, you know, it was making new highs in January, but a lot of the smaller companies, which is where I focus, because that's where the most opportunity is, I mean, they've been declining really for 2 years now. I mean, a lot of them started the year down half already from the peak. So they were quite cheap. And, you know, as the COVID crisis got worse, a lot of these stocks just got destroyed. I mean, a lot of them dropped another half or more. I mean, the Russell 2000 was down by half.
Right.
And, you know, small caps tend to be down by more. So I was looking at this, and I'm just saying, you know, how bad could it be? I mean, start plugging in some numbers. At the time, everyone thought that this thing was, you know, really going to kill a lot of people. And, you know, people were saying, oh, there might be 1 million dead people, 2 million dead people in America. And I'm starting to say to myself, okay, so that's less than 1% of the population, you know. You could kind of look at that, think it all through, and say that really doesn't move the number in terms of overall American GDP. You know, the risk is that government politicians shut the economy. It's not that people die. And the risk is that people don't go out and do business. But as I start combing through the data, I came to the conclusion that, you know, this virus really isn't that dangerous. It's catchy. But it's, you know, a bit worse than the common cold. It's going to kill some people. It's going to be kill some more people than traditional flu. I'm not trying to, you know, downgrade how severe this is, and it's terrible if, you know, you're one of those people that dies. But, you know, overall, this thing just isn't as bad as the media made it out to be. And as I figured that out, I just started buying with both hands. I always say you don't buy all at once. You kind of scale down. But over a 2 or 3 day period, I put all of my available capital to work. And I have a blog, Adventures in Capitalism, and I wrote on my blog, now it's time to buy. I didn't go out and say today's the day, you have to buy it today. I just said, if you're not buying down 50%, then you're doing this all wrong, because, you know, you get one of those opportunities about every 10 years. It's always kind of terrifying. And it eventually goes a little lower. You feel stupid, and then it goes up a lot. You never use margin. You never, bet the farm. But you want to be buying when it's down. And it just felt like it was a washout, particularly because as you go through, my Twitter feed, you go through my friend network, everyone was panicked. Everyone was a virus expert. Everyone was selling. Everyone was buying puts. I mean, I can't believe a bunch of these guys got short near the lows. It's insane.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're going to start buying puts when the VIX is at 90.
So, I mean, it just felt very pregnant to say, you know what, something, this thing seems a bit overdone to me, and I'm going to buy, and I'm going to buy aggressively, and that's what I did.
Now, when you look back on that, now, obviously, you made the right call. We bought some there toward the bottom, but it was very, very specific individual names. When you made that call, were you expecting to see? I mean, we knew what the response was. We saw the lockdown coming at that point. Even when you were, I don't think it had gone into full. No, it had gone into full effect, at least here in Washington State. We were kind of a hotbed there in the beginning days. But were you expecting the government to take action that would be so damaging to the economy? Was that even baked into the cake as far as you were thinking, or was it simply a market reaction thing where you said, okay, this has gone way too far, way too fast, VIX is at 90, everybody's panicking? Do you look back on it, or is it one of those scenarios where you're surprised the extent of the economic damage and the fact that the rally still took place, or did it kind of fit the way you were looking at things at the time?
Well, I'm stunned they locked down the economy over the cold. I mean, we've had much worse pandemics in America that actually killed a lot of people, and they didn't lock it down. This just seems like an overreaction in every way, and no one could have ever predicted that, you know, the government would do something insanely stupid, but it's the government, so I guess you should expect that. I mean, one thing I should point out is that, you know, I've been following this pandemic for a while. Back in January, I had about 10% of my portfolio in companies that were making masks, companies that were making protective gowns, companies that were, you know, plays on this virus. I'd been watching it go through China. I'd been watching it and saying, it's probably going to come to America because it's escape quarantine. And that first night when the market was down quite a few percent here in, the U.S., you know, I wrote on my blog, anything that you have now that you've always wanted to sell and you were waiting for a better price, but you don't have conviction, you ought to sell it because the market's probably going down. So, you know, I had raised a bunch more cash and I was just ready for this. And, you know, it helps to be positioned when you're sitting on a lot of cash. It lets you think clearly and, you know, not be in sheer panic as, you know, you're margined out and your portfolio is collapsing. Sorry, what was the other part of your question? Like, did I expect them to screw it up as bad?
Yeah, screw it up as bad. And then because, right, that was part of the influence, that was part of the thesis or the underlying motivations behind the call to get in there and buy with both hands. And then you've literally watched them, in my opinion. And look, and there's protections. I'm very sympathetic to your view. My view all along was, again, we were watching this in January and we had the portfolio prepped, high levels of cash. We were long vol going into it. So we really held up well during the downturn. But watching the steps they took, it just, to me, look, they had to do things, right? There were sections of the populace that they had to protect. But the analogy we used here was right from the beginning. It's like we had a housefly problem and they walked in with a bunch of guys with 12-gauge shotguns, right? And just start blowing holes in everything. And that was and when I started watching the damage that was being done, even as markets dropped, I sat there and thought, this is going to be the greatest economic shock in the history of this country. Now, you know, we have a single quarter where we're going to post probably somewhere around a 50% total GDP decline. So in a lot of ways, that came true. But I was not expecting to watch this sustained market run back up after I started watching the extremely damaging actions government start taking. Did that start influencing your bullish view on things, or did you think markets would just rally regardless?
Oh, I thought we'd go straight up. You know, if you look at stock markets really are just a function of liquidity. I mean, small companies have a bearing on valuation because, you know, they could always be LBO'd. They could always be acquired by someone else. Valuation has to make the backdrop of what you own. But the larger companies above $1 billion, they're mostly just cross-owned by various ETFs. The ETFs programmatically just buy stuff. There's no thought put into why or how. And valuation increasingly is irrelevant in how these companies trade. I think that's one of the mistakes that a lot of my friends keep making, where they're shorting overvalued stocks and they wonder why they don't go down. I mean, they don't go down because they're cross-owned by a few hundred ETFs. They keep buying more. And, you know, I just knew that as soon as they threw liquidity at it, the liquidity wouldn't seek out individual companies. It would seek out ETFs. And the ETFs would then do what they do, which is buy the individual companies, and the whole thing would go up. Because in the end, you know, if they're going to print a bunch of money, what are you going to do? Buy treasuries at, you know, zero interest rate? Like, where are you going to put your money? You don't have that many choices. So you're going to buy SPY, or you're going to buy QQQ, or you're going to buy some tech ETF. And it basically played out like I thought it would. And, you know, I've been as long as I can be, you know, in terms of feeling safe for my clients since the bottom. You know, I've cycled a bit around in terms of positioning, you know, but for the most part, I've just been, max long.
Well, that's kudos to you, man. The biggest mistake we've made is just not being aggressive enough. And we are very much a value-oriented shop. I mean, that was my start. That was my come up in the business. That's, you know, we've got a joke, which, well, it's not just ours, but, you know, value investors are born, they're not made, because of bouts of times like this. But it's really, you know, it's had a big influence on me the last 6-7 years, where we have diversified away. We've got parts of the portfolio that are strictly aimed at momentum because of the very thing you're talking about. Now, the interesting thing that you brought up here with the impact that ETFs are playing was actually one of the hit lists that I wanted to get with you or wanted to speak with you about when we finally connected, which is Mike Green has done, you know, Professor Plum. I'm sure you're familiar with Mike's work.
Yeah, I've met him. He's a sharp guy.
Yeah, about as sharp as they come. And I...
Absolutely.
Yeah, scary smart, right? And he's done a lot of work on this and on the ETF impact on markets in general. How much of that do you think is driving this? I see it as a central point. I think Mike is spot on. Do you think... Are we at a post-valuation period in markets now where just valuations just don't matter and they're not until they do? Because, you know, we can look at it, you know, at treasuries like you were talking about. And, you know, what if zero is the discount rate on a discounted cash flow model, you can justify a lot of things. Will valuations matter? Is it something you're considering right now, or until this wave of passive and you know, it's so self-reinforcing, right? It's incredibly reflexive, so I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon. What are value investors to do? Is there a period of time where it matters again? Or are we just sitting this on the sidelines indefinitely until some point it does in the future? I mean, what are we left to believe? For the guys of us that are still looking at balance sheets and cash flow statements, should we just throw it away? I mean, or you know, where do you think we go from here?
Well, in the end, valuation has to matter because you're investing in a business and not just a ticker symbol. You know, that's a long-term view. And as we know, you know, stocks can pretty much trade at any price at any time. Short-term, you know, I've been calling this whole environment Project Zimbabwe because if you look at, if you look at like the stock market in Zimbabwe, Mugabe takes over in early 1980 and it just starts going up.
Yeah.
And first it went up because the IMF and everyone went to bail them out because apartheid was over. And then their government starts printing money and they start printing more. And if you look at the slope each decade, it starts going steeper and steeper until, you know, the stock market just starts doubling every day. And that's just because they're printing money. It has nothing to do with the strength of the economy. You know, by that point, there really was no economy. They were growing bananas and, you know, that was it. There was nothing left to the economy. I went to Zimbabwe and what was it, 2011? There was just nothing. There was no running water. There was no electricity. I mean, there was really no food on the shelves. They'd screwed the whole thing up. You had to visit the stock exchange, and it was up 300% that day. And so, you know, I don't think we're going to get that bad here in the United States, but I think that Project Zimbabwe analogy is the most important thing you can use in terms of how to think about investing right now, which is that there's going to be more and more liquidity thrown at the world, and that liquidity is going to find a home. And it might not make a lot of sense. You know, the central bank can print the money, but it really can't direct it to where it's going to go. And, you know, the U.S. government can, you know, do things with tax policy and other things that can influence where the money goes. But the money goes in funny places. And, you know, just like you could have tech stocks that trade at 100 times sales, I mean, 2 years ago, we had a bubble in fake currencies, you know?
Right.
You don't know where this money's going to go, but I really do think Project Zimbabwe is the analogy you should use, because you had companies in Zimbabwe with no revenue, yet their stock prices doubled every day. Like, they literally had no working capital, they had no revenue, they had no employees anymore. They were just ticker symbols, and they doubled every day.
Okay, so to your point, we've also seen a similar dynamic play out in Venezuela, right?
Absolutely.
Stock market just going through the roof, you know, the country deteriorating, collapsing around it while stocks go parabolic. Obviously, it'd be a little bit, throwing a lot of big words out there, it'd be a little bit hyperbolic to say that, you know, like you said, we're not there yet. But it seems like we sort of crossed the event horizon during this last crisis. I mean, from the Fed backstopping the corporate bond market. Basically, they just came out and said, look, we're going to pump until we get the desired effect with no limits, no guidance, right? We're going to keep rates at zero for 30 months or something, you know, just unprecedented. When you look at the structure of the market right now, and do you really see no limit to how nuts this can get? Is there an end point that you're watching for? Is there a road sign somewhere that you're looking to, you know, to tell you when things get a little too insane, or is it just ride the wave and see what happens?
Well, it's going to be Project Zimbabwe. They're going to just go crazier and crazier because the stock market itself has taken on something of a, you know, strategic asset to the government. And it's the applause meter, and there's an election coming up, and there'll be another election after that, and then another election. And a lot of Americans own stocks, whether they own a lot of stocks or they own a few hundred dollars in their Robinhood account. And they're going to keep pushing stocks up. And I really think it could just get super crazy, Zimbabwe crazy. I just don't know how insane they're going to take it. But it's going to take a political decision to stop this, just like this giant bubble they're blowing is a political decision in the first place.
Well, that's a really interesting thing that you bring up, because we've been working on this for quite a while. And and I'm not the only guy to come to this. But what I've been saying for a couple years now is that the value investor inside of me is dying. I mean, he's like all hurled up. It's like the crying game, you know. I'm like all curdled up in the bathtub, just weeping, because I don't really think they've got any other option, right? I think that they've painted themselves into a corner where, if we were doing some work on this, and don't hold me to it, because we did this probably about 2 months ago, but we looked at it and said, if they just balance the budget, remember the days of the balanced budget, Clinton came
in. Oh, that's never going to happen again in my lifetime.
No.
Forget about it.
Well, if we looked at the math, if you balance the budget, didn't even pay down any of the debt, right? Just balance the budget. Now, forget about a surplus. Just get us to a balanced budget. You'd see something like a 4.5% to 5% hit to GDP in the individual year, which would be a hit to the economy that was, you know, 25% greater than the financial crisis, right? So who is going to advocate doing the responsible thing when, you know, you and I both know if these markets had to run in a traditional, right, on their merits, you know, you could see anywhere from a 60 to 70% drop in a heartbeat. So they're just going to print till something breaks, right?
Right, and they might print after it breaks, too. You know, eventually inflation is going to take the printing press away, but the timing of that is impossible to predict, and you just don't really know. Or, you know, the only other thing that could take the printing press away is some sort of political decision where someone comes to power politically who is against printing money. Because right now, everyone is in favor. I mean, I remember the old days when Republicans used to be about balancing budgets and, you know, fiscal propriety and, you know, the Democrats wanted to spend. Now the Republicans spend just as bad.
Oh no, it's almost it's turned into a contest, right? I mean, who can print and spend the most money and convince the public that they're doing God's work, right? Okay, so when we look into this, then would you think where are we at as far as sector rotation? Is tech what you're obviously looking at the more mid cap, small cap type companies? That hasn't exactly, you know, it's you and I have gone over your performance. You've obviously fared much better than the small cap indexes have. But that actually, that hasn't been a great place to be either. Do you think you're going to, I mean, how much longer does this tech run roll? Like you mentioned, the valuations on some of this stuff, you know, trying to adjust our thinking around a new world setup where valuations don't matter for the time being. But there's a certain point you'd think, a maximization point where you'd go, you know, does Shopify go to 200 times revenue? Right.
Why I mean,
Right. So do you think an analog, one of the things we've been looking at is I think that you've got a remarkably similar setup to Japan in the '80s. Do you think we could be looking at some kind of blow off top like that?
Yeah. I don't even know if it's blow off. I just think we go a lot higher. I think they're going to keep printing money and stocks will keep going higher and it's not going to make any sense. And I don't really know where the money ends up going. You know, part of me says it ought to go into gold or ought to go into other inflation assets, but you know, it seems to want to go into Shopify instead and Tesla. And, right. You know, it'll go into there. We had a little bubble in fake EV companies this week. You know, your Nikola and your Solo and your Workhorse. Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you just can't predict where the money's going to go. And, you know, for centuries, governments have printed money and tried to direct it where they want it. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I don't think our government even knows where it wants to go. They're just printing money at this point. You know, I think the next one that's going to go, if you kind of judge the mood of people, is probably crypto again. You know, if I had to guess what the next crazy bubble is, just because they haven't inflated that one in 2 years. And, you know, it seems like most of the Robinhood day traders like fake assets. So it's like the only fake asset that hasn't gone.
No, I know. We were actually just talking about this the other day where I was sitting there going, you know what, get ready. I just feel a Bitcoin surge coming because why not, right? I mean, why not? And the crazy thing about it, if you look at it from a philosophical point of view, you can make the argument. And I'm not, my clients currently, unless they do it outside of us, we've gotten them no exposure to crypto for a variety of different reasons. But, you know, in this environment, who's to say you can't have a $500,000 Bitcoin, right? Or $1 million Bitcoin, right?
Why not?
Why not? Why not at this point? Why is that any different than Shopify trading at an 80 times revenue? Why is that any different than us assigning an actual value to the U.S. dollar, right? I mean, why not? If we're printing $6 trillion of things out of thin air, how valuable can they be?
Right. I mean, all numbers and all valuations are all sort of unhinged from reality. So it's kind of like a make it up as you go sort of world.
Now, do you think this will continue? What about your look in terms of internationally? Do you think this will be because for the most part, last 12 years, right, this has been a uniquely American phenomenon, right? I mean, we've seen it in other parts of the world, but it seems like the only economy that's really benefited as far as asset prices go is the U.S. economy. Does this start to bleed out internationally, or does this stay U.S. focused basically off the, you know, the argument or the idea that we're the world reserve currency, so this is where the game is? How do you see that playing out?
Oh, I think you're going to have a global bubble in assets. I don't think this is just a U.S.-centric sort of bubble. Every other country is printing too much money, too. And, you know, you have the international investors. They're kind of chasing the Teslas and Amazons of the world here in the United States. But, I mean, eventually they're going to start chasing their own assets, too. You know, ignore the stock market. We've had giant bubbles in property assets internationally. We've had bubbles in, you know, fine wines and paintings and antique cars. You name it, we've had a bubble in it. It's just that, you know, when it comes to public equities, it seems to be American equities. But these bubbles have been just popping up everywhere.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a target-rich environment for sure. Now, on the focusing, again, pulling back a little bit and just focusing here on the U.S. like we were, what are you focused on a certain thing? I wanted to bring up loot. You've been talking a lot about but again, one of the reasons I want to bring it up because I thought it was a great idea, and it's been an incredibly successful trade. Tell us a little bit about that, the genesis of that, how you got onto that, and how that trade's working. If you think there's any juice left in it.
So, I mean, just a backstory on myself. I run a fund. Our fund has done one thing and done it very successfully. And, you know, before the fund, I did, you know, with my own private money very successfully, is find a trend at an inflection, get there right at the inflection point when assets are the cheapest that they're going to be, and then ride the future trend. And sometimes these trends last only a couple of months. Sometimes they go for many years. You don't really know. You just ride the trend until you can't ride it any longer. And so as these riots first started picking up, and this was over a month ago, the first day of the riots when they were just kind of small, I said to myself, this is going to expand. I could just feel it. This is just anger out there and people kind of, you know, pent up rage. And so I went out there and I was joking amongst friends, I'm going to create an ETF called Loot, you know, because I want to own the companies that do well when a lot of people just go out looting. So we bought the gun makers, Ruger, which I still own, Smith & Wesson, Visto Brands, they make bullets. You know, we bought companies that help police, like Axon, which, they, you know, they make tasers. I bought a company called VTSI, which they do simulators for police so that they can practice diffusing tense situations. It's just like a simulator for, you know, how to deal with a riot. You know, I bought some Corrections Corp. I bought some, Digital Alley. They make the police cameras. I just bought this basket of these things. My biggest one was Ruger. And it's done phenomenally well for me. You know, a lot of these companies have more than doubled in a month. It's kind of what I do, which is, like I said, you find these trends at an inflection. You get there right at the inflection. And you make sure the valuation is quite cheap. And so that if anything goes well, you know, you get a lot of upside. And it kind of happens really fast. And so I'm still in Loot. You know, I've been shifting the book around a bit. I booked a few of these. You know, Ruger more than doubled, so I had to take it off. But for the most part, I think this is a trend that's going to last a while. It doesn't seem like these riots are ending. They seem to kind of like, you know, calm down for a few days, flare up. Someone does something stupid, it flares up again, then it kind of calmed down again. I think it's going to be an ongoing trend for a while because you have a lot of really pissed off people.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say to you, and I don't see our political structure or the political apparatus that's currently in play in both parties, you know, all the DC is I'm including in that. I don't see them making the choices or the pivots that are going to calm this down at any point. Right.
Well, I think they're going to probably make it worse because what they've learned over the last few years is that identity politics works, you know, anger sells, and they're going to just pull people away from the middle. And you see this in, you know, the elections and the primary process. The people who are more extreme tend to get more attention, and it just kind of pulls people away from the center. And, you know, America was always a very centrist country. I used to joke, I have a lot of international friends, I do a lot of business overseas. You know, 10 years ago, I used to joke that I couldn't tell the difference really between the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, they were kind of the same party. And, you know, over the last 5 or so years, the extremes have gotten more extreme on both sides. And part of this is social media and the echo chamber where no one can actually think logically. But I don't know. It's very unhealthy for the political system we have because I feel like, you know, the 5% on either side who are most extreme are getting all the attention and they're kind of warping everyone else's minds. And I feel like the politicians will keep feeding on this because that's how they get voted.
No, you know, Ben Hunt. Epsilon Theory, you know.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I had him on the show, and we started off. Ben is much more traditionally on the left. I historically have been somebody who's much more conservative. The older I get, I tend to become more libertarian. But I don't really identify with any party because of a lot of the things you're saying.
I hate all the parties.
Yeah. Oh, I think the parties themselves are one of the biggest sources of problems that we've got. Right. You know. Look at the choices we've got for the upcoming election, right? I mean, it's like an episode out of The Simpsons.
Yeah, you got a corpse and a crazy guy.
Right, yeah. So, and hey, and not to offend the Trump lovers out there, not to offend, you know, we it's unique, Cuppy, because we're on two stations. One of them is the conservative talk radio show, and then one of them is decidedly, you know, more middle of the road, definitely, you know, leaning further to the left, and I hope I don't, you know, Okay, you got to worry about offending people no matter what you do these days, right?
That's my job.
Yeah. Well, you do a pretty good job of it on Twitter. You've never offended me. But anyway.
Give me some time.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah, it's like Novocaine. Give it some time and it'll work, right? But looking at this dichotomy that's developed, and this goes to what we were talking about like not seeing a trend change, not seeing anything happen, there is no incentive on either party to pull back the reins of the spending. There is no incentive on either side of the party to pull back the Fed, which really lends itself to your thesis about things just going up and to the right, I guess, into perpetuity. Is there a blowback? Like you said, there are going to be inflationary pressures. Do you think it's going to take if I look at the price of gold right now and you drop me down here, and just 10 years ago, you told me what was going on. You told me what the Fed had done, the government. Gold's performed great this year. It's been a best performing part of our portfolio overall. No complaints. But if I knew what was happening, I would think you'd probably be looking at 2,300, 2,500 gold, and it was racing higher as we spoke. We haven't seen that reaction. We haven't seen it out of silver. We haven't seen it out of the typical places that you'd expect to see it. We're seeing it certainly out of tech stocks and segments of the market. Do we really have to wait for some of that stuff, in your opinion, to blow up before we're going to see allocation of capital that seems to reflect the realities on the ground? Or do you think that will be like an overnight shift just all of a sudden? What are some of the warning signs you're looking for to get to a point where you go, okay, we got to start allocating capital on more traditional, parameters, right? Where we got to start paying attention to value again. We need to have gold as part of the portfolio. What would tip you off?
Well, I don't know if value is going to come back for a very long time, quite honestly. I think they're going to keep printing. And if they keep printing, archaic traditional concepts like valuation might not matter as much. I mean, yeah. I'm still a deep value investor. I believe that, valuation is the only thing that matters. And, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. But, it might not work as well as it should because I don't think valuation really matters. When it comes to gold, it's just a number. There's absolutely no fundamental reason for one price versus another price.
Right.
I've seen all these models. I think they're all made up. Gold is just an emotion. And
yep.
It will one day go higher. It, inevitably will go higher out of people buying it out of fear. It's kind of like its own VIX. But I don't know when that moment is. I assume that, Project Zimbabwe will continue to terrify people and chase them out of bonds that yield nothing and into gold that, yields nothing as well.
Okay, now this is a little bit backward sequence. And I don't know why, but I always prefer to do this a little bit. Yeah, I want to get into, you obviously have a unique perspective. For instance, what I mean by that is that I can tell within 5 minutes of reading your tweets that you probably didn't start as a financial advisor working at Edward Jones. you know what I mean? And I've come up in both worlds, and I don't mean that, I see that as a positive thing. Where did you start? Kind of give us the genesis of your career, what you've done. I know you're running your own fund now. But kind of tell us how you came to see the world the way you do and how you got into markets to begin with.
Sure. So, I didn't All right. come the traditional route. I started trading stocks in high school when I should have been going to class. I almost failed out of boarding school, quite honestly. And then I went to college, and I was making good money in college investing and trading. My background's trading stocks, the old school day traders. It really didn't have a valuation backing until I learned more about, what these ticker symbols on my screen were. It was really just a trading focus. But anyway, I started making pretty good money as a day trader, and I only started with the $6,000 I got from cleaning pools one summer. And so by my sophomore year of college, I was making more money than my father, and he was a doctor, and he had gone to school for about a decade. So I told my dad I was going to drop out of college, and he told me that I wasn't allowed to, but I could do whatever I wanted in college. So I'd always been interested in history, so I became a history major just to get a degree. But I put about zero effort into college outside of the drinking part. And my senior year of college, I started a hedge fund. I had been, you know, talking to my dad's golf buddies and giving, you know, stock tips, and some of them had been unusually successful. And after a while, people just said, hey, you know, I don't see you all the time. I don't know when to buy. I don't know when to sell. Why don't I just give you $50,000 and you can sort it all out? So I started a hedge fund with $90,000 in it in 2003. And I grew it from there. And, you know, that's kind of where I got started. But my background is from the history angle, which is why I look at everything and say, you know, has this happened before? How has this happened before? How has it played out?
Right.
The funny thing about markets is that there's a pretty good history with a lot of data going back well over 100 years that you can look at what's happened. And then, you know, there's some spotty data going back another 500 years or so in terms of financial markets. So everything that's happened today has happened in some other country, and yep. It's happened in some other industry. These things go in cycles. I tend to look at cyclical industries just because, you know, the cycles just keep repeating.
Yep.
You know, in a lot of these sectors, I'm on my second or third cycle already in my 20 years. So I have notes. I know the management teams, you know, the executives change companies, but I have relationships. It's just like an interesting thing because they keep repeating, and no one seems to learn the lessons of the last cycle or the cycle before. So, you know, I think that makes me think about things differently.
Yeah, no, that's probably what drew me to your feed, because I'm much the same way. I'm a history buff, specifically military and economic history. And it really is amazing to watch the same things get Trump, you know, drug out over and over and over again. The reactions are similar. The behavior is similar. And, you know, we all believe that, right? We're so much smarter than the people were 50 to 70 years ago. God forbid we're comp ourselves to people 200 years ago, right? They're dinosaurs compared to us, right? And that's just not the case. I think it's a common misconception. And you see those patterns repeating themselves over and over and over again. And I thought your Project Zimbabwe is a perfect example of that. This is not new. I think there are a lot of people hesitant to say that that's what's going on. Yet it certainly is. And look, it doesn't matter what you think about politics. Maybe you don't agree with Cuppy and I, but you know, you can talk about debt all you want. Bush doubled the debt. Obama came after him. He doubled the debt. Trump's on his way to doubling the debt. Right? Right. And think of the different the stump speeches here, right? We, like you said, we've got one party that's supposed to exemplify or be the standard bearers of fiscal prudence. You know, and they're spending like a bunch of drunk sailors, just like the other party is. And it doesn't change, right? It's just the same thing over and over and over. We've seen the bubbles before. When you started in high school, what did you graduate? What, 95, 96-ish high school?
99.
99. Okay, so you and I are virtually the same age. I graduated in 2000. So when you first started your day trading thing, that was, you were kind of the Robin Hood of yesteryear, right? You were one of the Robin Hood traders of yesteryear. Would that be fair?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess, sure. Call me a Robin Hood. But, I mean, I was trading from the short side.
Oh, you were?
I was getting run over.
Yeah. Oh, you were shorting it.
Well, I just said, this is insane. This is a bubble. This is crazy. And, you know, I kind of got ran over on the short side until I eventually learned some things about, you know, the fact that, you know, price and action and charts, you know, they're very divorced from actual fundamental data. I mean, long term they line up again, but short term they're very divorced. And I kind of ignored a lot of the tech stuff that was going crazy. Now, I was that guy who was buying Philip Morris at a 20% dividend yield and 3x cash flow, and then wondering why it keeps going down every day until it stopped, and then it went up 5 times in 2 years. You know, so I just came at it from a different mindset. But I was also trading a lot in and out, just looking at charts. Each day there'd be patterns and news, and you know, I kind of approached it in both directions. But I increasingly went more on the fundamental side just because I felt I had more of an edge in terms of analyzing information as opposed to, you know, guessing which direction the next dollar would be on some stock. And, you know, especially when you launch a hedge fund, you start taking clients, it has to be fundamentally based. And, you know, we had a little mini recession in 2002, and a lot of small cap companies just got obliterated. So when I started my fund in January 2003, you had all these little consumer companies that were trading at like 2-3 times earnings, and they're growing really fast, and they had no debt. And it was just so easy because you buy these things. And, you know, I was buying them at 3 times earnings, and 2-3 years later, they were at 15, 20 times earnings. Plus, the earnings doubled over those 3 years. It was impossible not to make money. You know, at the same time, you had China awakening, which, you know, from my history world, I just knew would be a major thing in terms of the commodity side. And so we were really big in commodities. And, you know, I remember riding copper from 80 cents to $3 and everyone telling me that copper was going back to 80 cents. And you know, I just kept being like, nope, it's not. Nope. And, you know, we just made money in all these things. I made a fortune in tankers. I was the biggest win for a while. And then, you know, I even had a bigger win in uranium when I caught that trend. So anyway, you know, I had a bunch of really great wins over those couple years. It was all fundamentally based.
Hey, do me a favor, would you? Can you push that microphone a little bit back? We're getting a little hot here on the either your mic's up a little too high or
me?
Close. Yeah, you're a little bit.
Can you hear me better or worse?
It's just that it's too hot, meaning that it's coming through too loud.
Is that better?
Yeah, there you go. Yep, yep.
All right.
Yep,
sorry about that.
Oh no.
I don't know. I'm rambling, so sorry about that as well.
No. This is exactly what we want to hear, man. So, so you caught. Now, you said the magic word, tankers, so we'll get into that. But you grabbed that uranium trade. What are your thoughts on uranium these days? Do you see a similar setup to the last period of time? Talk about depressed valuations. It doesn't get much more depressed. What are your thoughts on the uranium trade right now?
I mean, I wish I was more bullish, quite honestly. I'm just not as bullish as I probably should be, or maybe I don't know. I mean, to me, in the end, I feel like uranium's the sort of thing where the price is mid-30s right now. It's probably going to the 50s. It might even overshoot for a period of time, which is, you know, great if you own physical uranium. I think it's a great investment to have. In terms of the actual companies themselves, I mean, I think they're just terrible. I mean, most of them aren't producers. And if you look at the world, there's enough mothballed capacity that if they brought online a lot of the mothballed assets, you basically have sufficient uranium, depending on how many reactors are going to be, you know, needed in the world. You have either somewhere around sufficient uranium, or you need one of these greenfield projects to come online. That's all you need. So you have a bunch of these things kicking around, and you have people talking about these metrics like, you know, pounds of uranium in the ground to market cap, as if that matters at all. I mean, uranium is actually very abundant globally. What you need is high grade and low capex. And, you know, I'm not a geologist. I can't tell which of these 50 assets is the right one to own. And I don't think anyone who's pushing these properties has a clue either. You know, I see a lot of people who aren't geologists who are pretending they're geologists. They understand what they're looking at. You know, in the end, there'll be a few of these existing brownfield assets that come back online. I think some of them are reasonably attractive, but I mean, they're like 3-4 baggers. They're not as exciting as other things out there. With the, you know, the trade-off being that they're losing money right now as they sit there on care and maintenance, and they're diluting you. And it's just a terrible place to be, sitting there waiting for this thing to happen. I think there's just way better investments out there. I own some physical. I sold it. And I don't intend to get back in, I don't think.
It's hard to identify a catalyst. We have a small position in uranium that we picked up during some point in the last two and a half, 3 months. And we're up marginally on it. But the more and more I look at it, it's just really hard to identify a catalyst. And everybody keeps pointing back to the mid-2000s when they had that last, you know, that blow-off run where it just went absolutely nuts. And I've seen too many of those repeat trades come around where they don't play out the same way, right? And it just, it feels like that. It's been very hard for me. It's funny to hear you say that. It's been very hard for me to get excited about it. I see the potential. I see the numbers. But the other thing, too, is that, you know, people talk, uranium is one of those things where you don't see the demand double over the course of 6 months, right?
No.
It's very visible. And, you know, I think there will be more reactors built over the next 10 years. They're slated. But it's the market can adapt to that pretty, you know, I think the market won't have too bad of a time adapting to that. Now, to move on to a hotter topic. Now, this is one. This is one that I very much want to talk to you about, but I almost don't even want to bring it up because it has become such a contentious topic. The reasons for which I don't typically, I don't understand. I don't understand why this becomes so hot. But tankers. And first of all, let me say thank you to you because you're the one that turned me onto this trade, and it made all the sense in the world. And we made some good profits on there. We got in there really cheap. It didn't really look like that trend was continuing. It kind of seemed like it stalled out. We took some profits on it. I kind of kept one eye on it, expecting myself to be wrong, and it hasn't really taken off. Walk me through that a little bit in terms of we had massive inventory builds, but there's a lot of people out there saying the inventory builds didn't come anywhere close to what the predictions were. Walk me through the genesis of that trade. You'd had experience with them in the past. Walk me through the genesis of that trade, where you think we are, because when I look at them still today, it was tough to take profits, Cuppy. It really was, because I'm looking at these companies. I know the bad aura and the bad stuff that surrounds tankers in general, right? You've got some really shady management teams in there, and it's kind of seen as a shady industry. But it still looks ridiculously cheap. What happened there on the tanker trade? Why did we lose steam when we did? Were the inventory builds not as big as we thought they'd be? Kind of walk me through that.
So let me, I guess, take a step back. You know, I've become Mr. Tanker, which is never something I set out to be. I mean, tankers are still my biggest exposure in my fund, but, you know, I don't run a tanker fund. It's, right. You know, it's just part of a bigger piece. But I was quite vocal on tankers because I still am. Very big picture, what you have in tankers is you have a very small order book of new vessels. It's all about supply-demand, which sets the pricing. The global fleet is the oldest it's been since 2002. And tankers are kind of like a play on volatility, but it's geopolitical volatility. And I think we're entering a much more volatile geopolitical world. And I think that should play very well into tankers going forward. And so that's kind of what got me into tankers. You know, besides, of course, valuation, which is the linchpin of everything I do in investing. And when I started getting into tankers in Q1 2019, they were trading at discounts to net asset value. I actually think I got this one surprisingly right in that I started buying in Q1 2019, and we had five sequential quarters where each quarter charter rates on average were higher than the last. I mean, it was a 10-year bear market, and I literally caught the inflection, which, you know, I'm pretty proud of.
Yeah.
I mean, Q3 will be the first quarter that's not sequentially higher, though it is going to be quite higher than Q3 2019. So once again, you have a bull market going on here in tankers. I got pretty excited when COVID started because I saw a giant inventory build. When you think of tankers, you know, and this is, I think, the problem that a lot of the investors in tankers are making, or the mistake they're making. They're looking at this and they're saying, what's charter rates today? And then they're plugging that into their model, and they're saying, this company's worth this or this company's worth that. A tanker really is a leasing company. You know, if you own, say, an office building and you sign a 10-year lease, you have a lot of stability of revenue and cash flow. A tanker company is signing a lease that's somewhere between 30 and 90 days. There's zero stability of cash flow and revenue. They just don't really know what's going to happen. But, you know, the flip side of that is that sometimes things are phenomenally good. Sometimes things are not so good. When things are good, you can make 10% on your money each month. And then usually have a few turns of debt on that. You can make surprising amounts of money. And that's what we've seen over the past 9 months. 8 of those 9 months had tankers earning truly excess profits. And then what's going to probably happen is that Q3 is going to be all right. And who knows what Q4 looks like. Right now, charter rates are, you know, kind of mediocre. And, you know, you kind of look at that and you compare that to an office building. We have a lot of stability. But because of that stability, you earn 5% on your money each year. And then you put a lot of leverage on that. Here in the tankers, you can earn that in a single month. And so, you know, when you look at an office company or any other leasing business, you really need to look at it on a net asset value basis. That's how you're going to value this. And that's how I'm thinking about this conceptually, particularly because the cash flow is so irregular and erratic. And, you know, when you look at these tankers, a lot of them earn between half and 100% of their market cap over 9 months, which is really quite phenomenal. That's all been added to net asset value, you know, excluding the companies that paid dividends out. And now, right now, charter rates aren't so great. And we don't know when you'll have the next spike. But the money in tankers is made on the spikes. Most of the time, you're roughly in equilibrium. And, you know, your charter rates will be a few thousand above, a few thousand below your break-even on OPEX. So you're going to make or lose a few thousand dollars a day. But on the spikes, you might make a few hundred thousand dollars a day above your OPEX. And that's where all the profitability comes from. That's what you need to focus on. And you never know why there'll be a spike. It's always something. You know, this most recent spike was caused by COVID. The spike before that was caused by us sanctioning vessels from Costco. We had scrubber fit-outs, which caused a spike. There's been multiple spikes over the last year and a half. There'll be spikes in the future. And the money's made on those spikes. And no one knows when the next spike's going to be. And I think that's, you know, weight on the share prices, because people look at charter rates today and they say these companies aren't making any money, which is true. And they're forgetting that you can buy these fleets for less than half of net asset value. Debt levels are quite low. And there's going to be another spike in the future. You just don't know what will cause it. But you have a situation where the global fleet is quite tight, which is why the amplitude of the spikes has been so much higher than prior periods where there was an oversupply.
Gotcha, gotcha. So now, what happened on the the detractors on the tanker side? And I'll just say right out of the game, when it comes to tankers, I'm a neophyte. So this is my first foray into it. The detractors are all talking about the build going on. The build wasn't anywhere. I was looking across inventories, again, from my neophyte point of view as it relates to tankers. And I was seeing record builds across the entire complex. What is that argument? What are they referring to?
So the most recent spike was caused by the fact that the world went into lockdown. Supply stayed at 100 million barrels a day, and demand dropped to something like 70. And we started building up supply. And as you build up supply, first you fill land storage, and then you fill the floating fleet. And in the end, we built up somewhere between 1.5 and 1.7 million barrels at peak. Sorry, 1.5 to 1.7 billion barrels at peak, which is one of the biggest glut in the history of humanity. It's, you know, on a percentage basis, the biggest glut in recorded history. I'm sure you've had some bigger gluts back in, you know, the 1800s when there was really no demand. But it's a massive glut. And it filled up a lot of global tankers. And it took charter rates to all-time highs. You know, one of the reasons I'm so confident that we are in a bull market is because charter rates hit all-time highs. That's what happens during bull markets.
Right.
You hit highs, you have pullbacks, you hit new highs. And, you know, we had this huge inventory build. I think people maybe thought there'd be a bigger build. You know, when this thing first started, I said, you know, we're going to have a huge build. I said we might even get to 2 billion barrels at a time when people were saying we might only hit 100 million. Yeah, we hit 1.6, 1.7. I'm pretty happy with that guess because it was a pretty random guess as to what would happen, and we got pretty close. And, you know, when you go out there and you make a 20 sigma sort of prediction and you get it almost right, you kind of pat yourself on the shoulder because we had 4 months of truly excess profits where, you know, my largest position earned almost half its market cap in 4 months. I mean, I'm pretty proud of myself.
Yeah, yeah, it's not too
bad. I got it right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you and like I said, I got pointed to that trade off of your work and your recommendations, and we made some good hits on those too.
Great.
And it was, I got to tell you, it was tough to back out of them. We just saw the momentum suck out of that. And again, being a neophyte, right, your first trip through it, you're always a little more cautious. But the valuations still remain shockingly compelling. And so you're staying long. You're staying in there.
Yeah, I'm staying in. You know, I saw the momentum coming out of the stock, so I sold some calls. I took a little bit off But for the most part, I held what I had, and I've added it all back and then some. To me, when I look at these companies, you know, some of them are actually at the same price or even lower than where they were before this whole process started, even though the net asset value of these companies is more than doubled. And when they're increasing the net asset value, that's really because they're retaining capital and paying down debt, which is reducing the risk, you know, doubly fold. One, because there's less financial leverage, which makes them less risky. And two, because the net asset value is so much higher that, you know, the valuation is lower, and valuation is always what determines your risk. So, no, I've stayed with them, and, you know, I've been adding. I haven't really been adding big. I'm waiting to see some sort of catalyst for the next kind of shock that sends rates higher. But, you know, when that happens, I hope to buy a whole lot more. But I have a pretty full position still.
When you say – now, again, I'm not asking you for information on specific trades that you currently have on. But when you say you load up big, what does that mean? Are you taking 10% overall portfolio positions? Are you taking 20%? What is it? If you're going to back up the truck, if you got a high conviction play, what kind of exposure is the portfolio going to have to something like that?
Oh, it's going to be meaningful. You know, I run a fund. My focus is to have very concentrated positions. I'm totally agnostic about volatility. I expect volatility, actually. I'm targeting 8 to 12 positions, and a position's either a single stock or a sector theme like tankers. I'm trying to have them all be sort of non-correlated, though sometimes they are correlated. And I'm really looking for things that can go up five times. I'm not the sort of guy that buys a $10 stock hoping it's going to go to 13. You know, if I'm buying a $10 stock, you know, it better go to 50.
Yeah.
Or my model better say that there's a good shot that it can get there. So I'm really looking for what gives me the upside, because what I've learned is that you're going to make mistakes along the way, and it's your winners that make up for your mistakes. And, you know, even if you are really disciplined on valuation and everything else, you know, you're going to get some wrong, and, you know, hopefully you only lose 10%, but sometimes you lose more.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And the concentrated position, that takes some what kind of so when you say you're okay with volatility, what kind of volatility can you stomach? I mean, what kind of swings are we seeing? You and I are at different ends of it, because I'm dealing with retail money and you're running a hedge fund. But what kind of swings? I mean, what kind of swings have you seen in a year, right? What kind of volatility are we talking about here?
Well, my expectation is that if my fund doesn't have a down 30 pullback every 18 months, I'm probably doing something wrong.
So you've got an iron gut, man. You've got the...
It's not that I want to be down. I just know that if you think about this, and if you're going to be looking to have big returns, you have to be in sectors that are going to be volatile. And volatility for me doesn't usually come that I buy a stock at 10 and it goes to 5 and I go, whoops. It's normally that I buy a stock at 10, it goes to 30, and then it pulls back to 20. And, you know, you could say to me, hey, Cuppy, look, you went from 30 to 20, you just lost a third. And I'm going to say, no, we just doubled our money.
Right.
And, you know, we're kind of both right. And, you know, that's what happens when you're in sectors like this. And, you know, I think tankers are a perfect example. I have a cap at 35% in any one sector. I was pretty much at the cap when I put the position on. These tankers more than doubled, and then they've round-tripped. And so you could look at how the math works on that, and that's just one component of the portfolio.
Hey, you could also make the argument that over the same period of time, it'd be sort of like holding Berkshire Hathaway.
Hey, he's had quite a few down 50s.
And,
yeah. But the whole important thing is that stocks can literally trade at any price, and you have to accept that, which means that you have to be positioned for that, which means you have to make sure that you're not levered, that you have the balance sheet strength and the fortitude to see through one of these pullbacks and not panic. My blog has a lot of readers. I get emails from all sorts of people all day long. It's amazing to see how many people are in just sheer panic over these tankers as they pulled back. I mean, look at a chart of tankers going back 20 years. They do this all the time.
Oh, yeah.
If you didn't know this going in, then you shouldn't have gone in.
Right. No, I know. And
part of the reason I own tankers is because they are so volatile.
Yeah, that's where the juice is. That was one of the things you and I have talked off air about and DM'd about, which is you know, you guys, if you're out there following on Twitter and you're not doing your own due diligence and taking a look at these things, you know, I don't know what to tell you. Right. I mean, you got to do your own homework. You got to look into them. And then that is the other thing, right? That link between volatility and returns. And I think that's a really hard thing for retail investors to get their head around, the idea of, you know, that uranium trade. I don't know where you got in, but I know that trade back during that. I mean, it was pretty much, what was it, 05 to 07 is when it really heated up. Isn't that about right?
Right. So let's talk about the uranium trade. I got in right when uranium was about uranium was about $12. I got in when it was about $16. And I remember these stocks are all about 50-cent stocks. And I sized it pretty big. And a lot of them ran to $1, $1.50. And then, you know, these are companies that have no revenue. So they all did giant secondary offerings, and they diluted the hell out of everyone. And a lot of the people who bought these bought them to clip the warrants, and they started selling shares. And a lot of these stocks that went from 50 cents to a dollar went all the way back to 50 cents. Right. And so, you know, that means you lost two-thirds of your money if you paid $1.50. You know, for my clients and my hedge fund, you know, even though we had only paid 50 cents, round tripping, I mean, it was expensive in terms of overall performance. You know, I bought a lot more on the way down because the thesis kept getting better. And then, you know, a lot of these 50-cent stocks ended up going to $10.
Right.
You know, you just have to know what you own. You have to have confidence in it. And you have to kind of ignore the volatility. I just really don't care about the volatility. And it takes a unique sort of investor to have a similar view. I mean, I see a lot of my friends who have been in tankers all panic selling. And, you know, I don't know if that's the right move or not, but, you know, it seems kind of dumb to buy something at 20 and sell it at 10.
Yeah, well, especially when you pull up the chart on these things, you realize that this is what they do. Right. It's a crazy ride. Now, with that in mind, one of the interesting things that I've picked up from you is, with that in mind, you're willing to take speculative bets. You're willing to take these outsized positions and what some people would say is, you know, extreme risk. And yet you're not involved in these tech high flyers. Explain that to me.
Well, I don't understand these tech high flyers. I just
you
don't.
You and me both, pal.
Well, I don't understand what I don't understand the valuations. I don't understand what some of them do. I don't think most people understand what they do. And I don't understand why they have a competitive position that makes them attractive in any way. If a company has a business model that mostly entails losing money, and you're going to, you know, lose money to buy revenue growth that's unprofitable, you know, I call that a Ponzi scheme. Right. I don't want anything to do with that because I don't really think I'm buying anything of value. And a lot of these tech companies have no path to profitability, or their ultimate profitability is, you know, so minuscule compared to the market caps, you can't get excited about them. I mean, I would love to own high return on capital tech businesses, but, you know, I'm not going to be able to get them at anywhere near the multiple I'm willing to pay. And so, yeah, I have to go kind of dumpster diving in tankers, but that's okay. I mean, tankers can be a great business too.
Yeah, well, and they sort of have.
For periods of time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but look, I would apply the same thing to gold miners, right? I've been in and out of. Well, look, I've been involved in that industry for quite some time. My father and grandfather did VC deals on gold miners, and you can only imagine that kind of business, right? You have a couple hits, and then other than that, it's a lot of frogs to kiss, and a lot of incineration of capital as well. But these things are not long-term in nature. They can be incredible investments, but you gotta know when to take your money and run and get the heck out of the way. You're not a fan of the miners. I picked that up. Kind of give me, have you had experience with gold miners, or have you danced to that tune before, or is that just something that you've looked at from the outside and just said, no, thanks?
Oh, I've had a lot of experience with gold miners.
Okay.
You know, the problem with gold miners, and it's a problem with a lot of businesses, it's very Ponzi-esque as well, in that you're not really buying anything. You know, if you look at the juniors, you're really buying, you know, hopes and dreams.
Yep.
So it's not really a business. I don't know how to value it. I want nothing to do with it. And if you're looking at the producers, you know, it's really a terrible business. It's super capital intensive. You don't control your input costs. You don't control your exit costs. You know, you, with the price you sell the gold for. you have a lot of political risk. There's just so many ways you can lose money. And I've seen a lot of these companies find every possible way to lose money, and they keep finding new ones. It's just a terrible place to be invested. I want nothing to do with it, particularly because you can just buy gold itself and, you know, sell for what you want. People keep telling me that, you know, gold miners have leveraged the gold, but in the 20 years I've done that, I've never seen that actually happen. You know, I've seen individual gold companies be, you know, very successful, but a broad-based index of them has absolutely no leverage. If anything, it seems to have, you know, the opposite of leverage. You know, it has negative operating leverage.
Yeah, because you've got so many mixed in there that are just capital, just incinerators, right? And you've got a couple.
The way the whole thing is structured is just terrible. You know, you're highly correlated to the price of diesel because that's your big input. You have all these taxes. You have a depleting asset. It's a true commodity business in every possible way, except for, unlike growing corn, for instance, you're making a 10 or 20 year capital allocation decision, whereas, you know, the farmer could say, you know, corn doesn't look so good this year, we're going to do soybeans instead. You know, it's a much shorter timeline on the decision making, where with gold, you could be 15 years in and hit some fatal flaw in the geology or the mineralogy or something else, and, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar write-off, and these companies seem to keep writing off huge quantities of capital. It's just a terrible place to be.
Yeah, well, and then you've got regulatory issues, too, with, you know, the regulators all over you, especially, you know, nowadays with, you know, the whole green push. I mean, it's just become it's become a house of pain for a lot of these guys, especially in the junior space, which, you know, ironically, this has been one of those. Usually in the trend of these things, right, it's the seniors that take off first. It's the bigger companies. And, of course, this gold run, it's been the juniors, which we have no exposure to for a lot of the reasons that you've outlined.
Well, the juniors actually seem to go better for a while because they're more stock promote and hopes and dreams without
right.
any, you know, fundamental underpinnings. So they can kind of lie their way through for further, whereas the seniors, one, they need a lot more capital to move the share price. So you have a bunch of people like me that have access to capital that are super skeptical. And then, you know, you actually can look at the financial numbers and be like, so, you know, the price of gold has gone, you know, what was it, up $300 this year, and you guys still don't really make any money? You're kind of just covering your sustaining capital. Like, it makes no logical sense.
Yeah.
And for that matter, I would say that these royalty companies are even a bigger scam. I see a lot of people chasing these royalties, and I just think they're just terrible Ponzi schemes. I actually think the royalty companies might destroy more capital than you know, your actual mining companies. You know, I'm not going to short those because I don't short, but I think they're just horribly terrible.
Even like a Franco-Nevada, huh, who's had a really good return on...
Terrible.
I have not done a deep dive on them, but I've looked at their return profiles. I've never been involved in the royalty side of it because, again, the gold miners for us are a trade, and it's a trade. We'll never hold
just
one.
Just buy gold then.
Yeah. Well, and we've done that as well. What do you see? What are the issues you see with something like a Franco-Nevada? Have you dug into that one individually?
Let's talk about it as a group. I don't want to single out any one company.
Okay, gotcha.
But they all sort of own the same sort of assets, and they all bid against each other in each financing. It's kind of like an auction, and a banker says, hey, this company needs some money, and everyone bids on the terms, and you know, the mining company takes whoever gives the best terms. So it's actually a very competitive market in a way.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at this, it's really just a Ponzi scheme, okay? They trade at, let's call it, 50 times cash flow. When you go and look at it, that cash flow isn't really cash flow. They're just getting their money back. They put the money in. 5 years later, they start getting the money back. And in theory, they're supposed to get it back for 50 years, except they don't really because, you know, if you look through the history of these companies as a group, they seem to take billions in impairments each year. You know, so you're not even getting your own capital back. People like to say that these companies have leverage to gold, and to a certain extent they do. The price of gold goes up and you get a bit more revenue. But the real issue is that if you don't own gold because you think it's going, you know, to go from 1750 to 1850, like, that's not exciting. People own gold because they think that something structurally bad will happen in the world and gold might go to 10,000. And in that sort of situation where gold is there to protect you, I think a royalty company is probably the worst thing you want to own, you could own, because those royalty companies structured these deals in a way that they're buying gold super cheap from the producers. They're buying the gold so cheaply from the producers aren't profitable. Because if gold goes to 10,000 and you're still buying gold at 500, let's say, well, you know, in theory, the royalty company makes a lot of money, but I mean, the gold miner still has all their costs, and there's been a lot of inflation now, and they can't afford their costs, their diesel and their salaries and their taxes to their local governments and all this other stuff. I think you end up bankrupting your producer. It's kind of like what we just saw happen with commercial real estate. Guys kept raising rents over and over again, and they ended up bankrupting all the tenants. They took rents too high, and then you had a small little shakeout, you know, where, you know, 2 months into this crisis, no one could pay rent, and now I don't know what's going to happen. And I think that's the same thing that would happen with these royalty companies. And I just think they're terrible.
Okay, so now, in conclusion here, what are the things you're focused on? You've still got a good position of the tankers. You're still holding that. You're focused on loot. What else are you watching? And feel free to go off the rails as far as right. This is a rant enabled zone. Like I told you, we're all about the rants.
Rant enabled.
Yeah, it's rant enabled. You're green lighted, man. What you can speak both geopolitically. What do you see happening geopolitically? What do you see happening economically? What is our outlook? What is the Cuppy outlook for the next year, year and a half, 2 years?
I think you're going to have a very, very volatile world, both in American politics and global geopolitics. I think you want to be long volatility, which is why I'm long tankers. Plus, you know, tankers are just they trade at the cheapest valuation they've ever had. In all the data that I have going back in time in terms of a net asset value multiple. Meanwhile, they're actually the most profitable they've been in over a decade. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. Plus, you know, you get pure leverage to geopolitics. That's where I would put a lot of my energy. You know, I think the final point on tankers, which we didn't get a chance to make, is that the U.S., is going to produce less oil going forward just because the shale boom's kind of over. I also don't think there's the funding anymore to put a dollar in the ground and, you know, wait 3 years to get 75 cents back out. that cycle's been broken. And so if the U.S. produces a few million barrels less, we're going to have to import that from somewhere. And most likely that importation is going to involve tankers, which will drive demand quite dramatically looking forward, you know, 3-6 months, wherever it is, where we get past this drawdown of inventory. So, you know, that's another reason to be bullish. You know, I think in a volatile world, implied volatility stays elevated. There's a lot of companies out there that are reasonably good companies. Maybe they don't have, you know, huge amounts of upside, but they probably don't have huge amounts of downside either, whether it's balancing sheet strength or cash flow or some other metric of stability, where implied volatilities are way too high for the sort of businesses these are. And, you know, you could write puts right now at the money, a bit out of the money, and, you know, you're going to be making 10 or 15% a month, which, you know, that adds up really fast. And, you know, I've done more put writing over the years, and then, you know, you kind of pull back because implied volatility drops, then you get another chance. But I can't think of a time where, you know, you could have a basket of lots and lots of names. Usually it's one or two names you get to write on because, you know, implied vol seems higher than it ought to be. But here, I mean, the whole market seems higher than it ought to be. Because, look, if the VIX is 30, the VIX of small cap companies is 100.
Right.
And that doesn't seem right. Normally the VIX, you know, if you look at the last year this time, the VIX was like 12 and small cap VIX was 25. And you kind of look at it and say, there's no way I'm going to write a put. I want to be long vol. But here you have a chance to actually take the other side of that. I think crypto has a whole new bubble. I think it's coming pretty soon. I don't say you want to make this a big piece of your portfolio because, you know, quite frankly, I think, you know, Bitcoin is just a Ponzi scheme. But it's a Ponzi scheme that's inflating, and it's inflating rapidly. And you kind of want to be long that at least a bit. It's just another inflation play. I think loot's going to do just great. I love loot. And then hard assets, whether it's you know, natural gas, which I still have a little bit of exposure through my Sandridge, or property companies. I think interest rates are going to stay structurally low for quite a period of time. And I think you're going to have a lot of migration of people out of cities, whether it's because of the COVID or it's the violence that's going to come with these riots. But I think people are going to be looking to go to the suburbs. And I think for the first time really since 2007, you're going to have a boom in single-family homes again. And I think you want to be involved in the guys who are supplying the home builders. Home building itself is a terrible business. But there are guys who supply it, whether they're the guys who own the land or the guys who are selling the components of the houses. And those guys are going to see quite a lot of revenue growth. And that's another macro trend I'd be focused on right now.
Yeah, that trend is coming to the fore. We're seeing that. I mean, I think that one is in the process of taking off as we speak, this great migration into the urban centers. It seemed to have reversed itself in a hurry. And and we're seeing it. You're already seeing that price action. I think that you're, like you said, you know, rates are pegged, right? I mean, they you know, I think it's a high possibility you could see 30-year money sub 2.5. You know, look at our friends over in Europe. I was talking. I had Andreas Steno Larsson on the show. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's an analyst at Nordea, the I believe it's Swedish bank. And he was telling me he bought a condo in Denmark, and he's got a negative 0.2% mortgage rate or something like that.
You know, it's crazy, right?
It's insanity. But you look at all these other places around, right? They've been trial grounds for what eventually we end up doing here. And, you know, I don't think you're going to get great growth economically. They're going to have to keep jimmying the rates and keep pushing rates down to keep driving. You know, I mean, the home prices, but I mean, this has always been true to some degree, but I think it's especially true now that home prices have just become a derivative off mortgage rates. I mean, that's
right.
I mean, that's the whole game. 2018, 30-year money went from 3.3 to 5.1, and new home sales dropped by 19%. You know, they can't raise rates. So I'm with you on the residential housing market. Anything else before we wrap this up? Anything else that you feel is important to share with us or give us insights and, you know, enlighten us?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Well, a little bit tongue in cheek, but also I know you're a guy that spends a lot of time digging into this. A lot of really does his homework. There, people are going to disagree with you, but you don't. I've never seen you throw stuff out there that you didn't have a good handle on, do some good research on. So, other than that, no. I by the way, I'm with you on. Now, I haven't. It's kind of hard to do research on crypto, but seems
crypto is much like gold. It's just a number.
Right.
But it does seem... throw something out at you at crypto, because I found this interesting. This is product. The ticker symbol is GBTC. It's the Grayscale Crypto Trust.
Yep.
Okay. They keep raising. It's a closed-end vehicle. They keep raising more capital. They own about 3% of all the Bitcoin out there. If you look at the top couple hundred holders of Bitcoin, they own a disproportionate number of all the Bitcoin out there. Grayscale keeps just crunching away, munching away. Every week they buy more. Last week they bought almost $200 million worth of Bitcoin. You know, that's like 15 basis points of all the Bitcoin outstanding. You don't have to do that for that many weeks before you start consuming the free float. When you look at the free float, a good portion of it's been lost forever. You know, people forgot their codes. They don't know how to get into their wallets. Another bunch of it's locked up with true believers. The free float is kind of small, and they just launched another crypto trust in Germany. These things are going to start consuming the free float. When I say that Bitcoin is just a Ponzi scheme, that's because it is. But it's a Ponzi scheme because more capital keeps coming in than is going out right now. And during the move up in a Ponzi scheme, you know, that's kind of indicative of what you're supposed to see when prices inflate. And, you know, if they keep locking up this free float, there's going to be less and less Bitcoin setting the price. And at the margin, I think the price will go up. And as we all know, you know, FOMO is a big motivator of what happens in asset prices. And if Bitcoin gets above 10,000 and stays there for any convincing period of time, it's going to go a lot higher because all these Robinhood guys, they still have their crypto accounts. So I don't really know how to play this. I don't really understand it. I don't think anyone actually does it. But I think it's going higher. And I've seen a lot of these bubbles where you could latch on and just ride. And I think this is one like that.
Oh, yeah. No, well, especially in this environment. I mean, when we talk about the valuations, you know, like you and I were saying here earlier, you know, why not? And it does seem, right? It does seem due. We've been having the exact same feelings where I'm looking and going, oh, we got another, especially when you see a couple days in a row where you get those 10 and 15% pops in a single day. You know, the Robinhood traders today, it's kind of like, you know, they remind me of the, you've got kids. How many kids do you have? Two, three?
Not how many kids.
Oh, you don't have kids. Okay, I thought you did. So you're not as well versed on the Disney movies. See, I am. And there's a movie called, what was it? It was Up, right? Where they put this collar around the dog, and you'd be in mid-conversation, and the collar allowed the dog to speak English. Okay, so I'm taking you down a rabbit hole here. But you'd be in mid-conversation with the dog, and at any moment, he'd lose focus, and he'd be, squirrel, you know, he'd pop up, and he thought somebody said squirrel, and you know, everything went out the window. I kind of see these Robin Hood traders like that. Well, you know, they're all caught up in the bankrupt stocks. You know, that's who would have known there was so much money to invest in bankrupt companies or so much money to be made investing in bankrupt companies? I've been doing it all wrong. But as soon as they see a couple of those 10, 15, 20% days, I can just see that Robinhood attention, you know, just pivoting right toward Bitcoin and just, you know, putting 20,000 in the rearview mirror and having this thing just get silly high. I mean, look, there's no intrinsic value, right? I mean, the value, the networking, and I'm not trying to get out there and beat up on Bitcoiners. I'm just saying from a financial perspective, there's no cash flows. There's no intrinsic.
No, it's fundamentally worthless.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's just a play against fiat currency. And it really is an investment built on the back of the greatest fool theory, right? I mean, isn't that, that's, if you boil it down, that's sort of it. You're just hoping somebody comes along and pays you more than you paid. And I just think as soon as those Robinhood guys, as soon as this comes on their radar screen, I just see that, I just think we're going to have another parabolic run. Well, anyway,
yeah, that's inevitable.
Yeah, it sure seems so. So anyway, pal, I can't appreciate you more. Can't appreciate it more for having you come on. You taking the time to join us and at least update us on the tanker thing. We got a lot more out of you and, really appreciate the time, and it was a real blast to be able to toss things around with you and kind of get the cuppy view of the world. And we'll keep our eyes on you. And for those of you again that are just, you know, joining us or missed the first part of it, you can follow him at @HCuppy on Twitter. And then how do they get onto your blog? How do they read the stuff you're putting out?
So my blog is Adventures in Capitalism. You can sign up for updates. I send about one a week whenever I get around to writing. And you know, I've been doing it for over 10 years now, and I think my track record of picking themes and getting there right at the inflection is, you know, it's pretty good. I've had some mistakes along the way, but I think I get most of them right. And, you know, the reason I write on the blog is for the feedback I get. You know, I always learn something from readers who know the topics better than me, and it's a good way to stress test my own ideas. So that's why I have a blog, and, you know, I'm going to keep writing it.
Yeah, well, it's a great read, and I've seen you nail a couple of these, especially like you did the Turning Point this year. And I, again, tip of the hat, man, when you came out and got all bullish, I sat back and I went, okay, Cuppy has officially jumped the shark. We actually had this conversation without you being involved. Two guys that respect your take, me and Chase Taylor, Pinecone Macro. We had a conversation.
Chase, good guy.
Yeah, great guy. I think he was actually up here in our offices that day. And we were sitting there talking about your take on, and I just sat back and I said, look, man, Cuppy has got, he's got bigger guts than I do, for lack of a better term, just because I just thought that was a very premature bullish call. And look what happened. You had the greatest 50-day run of performance on the S&P 500 in history. So way to call that one, pal. And we're going to keep watching, keep listening to you. And if there's anything that pops up that you think is noteworthy and you ever want to discuss it with us, you feel free to reach out and we'll get you on in short order.
Sounds great.
All right. Have a good one. And thanks for joining us. And all of you, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and be back next week. Got another great interview dialed up. I'm not going to tip my hand. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You got to tune in to find out. But we will be back. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you in a week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.